This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 5th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, House Republicans push to weaken environmental regulations on mercury. The Occupy Wall Street protests get a boost from labor and community groups. And the Honduran president meets with Barack Obama. We'll take a look at the ongoing violence in that country 2 years after a military coup. Those stories and more coming up after these headlines.
I'm Alice Olstein with headlines for FSRN. A resolution condemning the Syrian regime came before the UN Security Council Tuesday, but was vetoed by Russia and China. 9 nations voted in favor, while South Africa, India, Brazil, and Lebanon abstained. Russian Ambassador Vitaly Churchkin defended his veto by pointing to the situation in Libya.
What we see is the policy of regime change and the policy of enticing the opposition.
U.S. Ambassador Susan Rice walked out of the chamber in protest and later told reporters,
"The fact of the matter is, despite the vote we saw today in the council, the majority of members supported the resolution. The majority of members would have supported a sanctions resolution. And the countries in the region are every day coalescing and raising their voices against what is transpiring in Syria."
Meanwhile, some individual countries are moving forward with their own measures against Syria. Canada is banning the purchase, transportation, or importing of petroleum products from Syria and has frozen the assets of individuals and entities. Turkey has also promised sanctions, though the prime minister has not released details. The country also plans to close their shared border with Syria. Thousands of striking workers in Greece are demonstrating today against austerity measures passed by the government in a last-ditch effort to save the country from bankruptcy. As workers walked off the job, flights were grounded, trains halted, public schools shut, and major museums closed. Police in riot gear sprayed tear gas on protesters outside Parliament today as they threw rocks and tried to storm government buildings. The government announced this week that it would miss its 2011 deficit reduction target by nearly 2 billion euros, and that it would start running out of money to pay salaries and pensions by mid-November. Audio courtesy of The Telegraph. After 6 hours of debate Tuesday night, Haiti's Senate ratified President Michel Martelly's choice for prime minister. But the new leader's ties to the UN are making Haitians wary of his motives. Ansel Hirst has more from Port-au-Prince.
President Michel Martelly took office over 4 months ago, but he has been delayed in assembling a government by the Senate's rejection of his first two nominees for prime minister, which some viewed as too right-wing. The third nominee, Gary Kinney, was seen as a less political choice, but he still engendered controversy because he lived outside Haiti for the past 5 years and is closely tied to former U.S. President Bill Clinton, who is the U.N. Special Envoy to Haiti. Kinney has worked at the U.N. for many years and translated for Clinton during his recent visits to Haiti. Saint-Louis Jean-Francois, who is middle-aged, unemployed, and has a bad back, is uneasy about what Kinney's ratification means for Haiti.
I have my doubts, because he worked for the international community, and it's him that they chose. Did the international community send him to do good work for Haiti? Me? I don't know exactly. Did the international community send him because they will profit from him? We don't know. They ratify him, so now we'll follow what happens and wait.
The U.S. Embassy issued a statement applauding Kinney's ratification this morning. Ansel Hers, FSRN, Port-au-Prince.
Nearly 250 schools are closed in Gaza today as teachers hold a strike protesting the 3-month suspension of their union leader. Thousands staged a sit-in today at the headquarters of the UN Relief and Works Agency. FSRN's Rami Almagari has the story.
Suhail Al-Hindi is a 48-year-old headmaster and head of the workers' union within the UNRWA. He was suspended for 3 months for involvement in political activities outside his job without permission. The UNRWA did not give details. Al-Hindi denies the charges.
The main accusation against me is I have participated in syndicate activities, which some Hamas ministers and the prime minister attended. I have never been involved in any political works. My work has always been for the union, for serving others.
Tension between the UNRWA and the teachers' union has been growing for the past several months after the UNRWA fired 3 teachers accused of domestic violence. The UNRWA Teachers Union warns they will step up protest measures in other areas run by the UNRWA, including Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, Rami Al-Mirari, Afasaran, Gaza.
President Barack Obama's Justice Department has been heavily criticized by Republican Congress members for the Fast and Furious program, which tracked guns from small-time dealers up the chain to major traffickers, but was racked by scandal. Yet law enforcement officers announced Tuesday that a Bush-era operation also allowed hundreds of guns to fall into the hands of arms traffickers. Caroline Jackson reports from Tucson.
Under Operation Fast and Furious, federal agents lost track of 2,000 guns sold in Arizona as they attempted to gather evidence against major arms traffickers. Less is known of Bush-era Operation Wide Receiver, which began in 2006 and ended a year later with no charges filed. During the program, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosive Agents in Tucson also allowed guns to be transferred to known arms traffickers. This according to testimony from two anonymous law enforcement officers. On Tuesday, House Judiciary Committee Chairman Lamar Smith called for President Obama to appoint a special counsel to investigate Operation Fast and Furious. But with new information about similar tactics and results under Operation Wide Receiver, some are calling for an investigation of both programs. Operation Fast and Furious became embroiled in scandal after two probe-related assault rifles were involved in a shootout in Arizona, where a Customs and Border Protection agent was killed. Caroline Jackson, FSRN, Tucson.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Washington, D.C., I'm Alice Olstein.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. This week, House Republicans are continuing their push to weaken environmental regulations. The Environmental Protection Agency says if the latest effort to lower air quality standards for mercury is approved, the health of thousands of people will be negatively affected. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
Lambasting the EPA has become a rallying cry for Republicans nationwide. At a time when job growth is anemic, Congressperson Todd Young of Indiana says the agency ought to halt imposing new regulations that were mandated by the Clean Air and Water Acts.
We cannot keep letting the EPA impose these burdensome and job-crushing regulations without any concern for how they affect our constituents.
The EPA is currently moving forward with an effort to force cement manufacturers to cut mercury emissions by more than 90%. But the industry opposes the move, citing the cost of installing new equipment. This week, Republicans have a bill on the floor that would effectively delay the implementation of that new rule for 5 years. Oklahoma Republican John Sullivan says the EPA needs to take more time to assess the impact of the regulation on the construction industry.
The purpose of this legislation is to provide EPA additional time to repropose and finalize its rules setting maximum achievable control technology and other standards for cement manufacturing plants so that the rules are both achievable and protect American jobs.
The EPA says the new rule could cost the industry around $1 billion, but would save between $7 and $18 billion, while also preventing up to 2,500 deaths and thousands of respiratory problems. Illinois Democratic Congressperson Bobby Rush says the GOP is being disingenuous.
I call it the Dirty Cement Pollution Bill. And let's be perfectly clear, Mr. Speaker, this bill this measure is not about jobs.
Cement is the second largest mercury-emitting source in the U.S. Rush says the new regulations that would go into place in 2013 are more than a decade past due.
Will allow for thousands of additional premature deaths and premature heart attacks, as well as tens of thousands of additional asthma attacks that could have been avoided. Mr. Speaker, the public health benefits from the reduction of air toxins emissions from cement kilns have already been delayed long enough.
In the Senate, legislation that's intended to improve the safety of oil and gas pipelines is also being held up. Last year, there was an explosion at a California pipeline that killed 8 people. The committee with jurisdiction over the bill passed the legislation tightening safety standards unanimously. But Kentucky Republican Rand Paul is blocking the bill from getting a speedy consideration by the Senate under rules that allow legislation to get fast-tracked if no senator objects.
We shouldn't just rush things through. It should strike people as unusual that sort of things just flowing through and there's not being a discussion of it. No amendments, no discussion of it. Take one afternoon for the Senate to hear the bill.
Paul says the National Transportation Safety Board just released its safety report on the California accident last week and he thinks lawmakers should take the time to examine the report before rushing through new regulations. But Democrats say it's a part of a larger effort to delay and derail new regulations. California Democratic Congressperson Henry Waxman says freshman Republicans are taking the nation down a dangerous path.
The House has voted 136 times this Congress to block action to address climate change, to halt efforts to reduce air and water pollution.
Now, with the House voting to undo the cement regulation that's intended to protect people's respiratory health, Waxman says voters aren't getting what they asked for.
The American people need to focus on the radical agenda of the Republicans that are controlling this House of Representatives. I don't think when the Republicans were voted into office, the American people voted for poisoning more children with mercury and letting more of our seniors die prematurely because of uncontrolled pollution.
The vote to cut down on mercury emissions from cement plants is slated for Thursday. In the coming weeks, the GOP is also expected to debate bills to slow down or stop new regulations for coal-burning power plants and industrial boilers. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Today, President Obama meets with Honduran leader Porfirio Lobo in an Oval Office meeting at the White House. The meeting coincides with Lobo's visit to the Organization of American States in Washington, D.C., where he pledged to put into practice recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that looked into the June 2009 coup of Manuel Zelaya. After Zelaya was removed from power, the country entered a new period of violence and instability. The arrests and killings of students, journalists, labor leaders, and activists continue under Lobo. For more, we're joined by Suyapa Portillo. She's a professor at the Central American Studies Department at California State University, Northridge, and an expert on the history of labor movements in Honduras. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
The White House says in a statement that Obama and Lobo will discuss a range of issues, including economic and security issues, at their meeting today. But Obama also said he will focus on Lobo's efforts to restore democratic and constitutional order in Honduras. What's your assessment of those efforts so far?
Pepe Lobo's efforts so far in Honduras have been insufficient since the Truth Commission report came out, actually calling it a coup and saying it was a coup and that the police and the government did act in some of the killings that happened during that period, during the coup. His efforts have been insufficient since then to really actually hold accountable the coup plotters and the police and the military. And in fact, military aid to areas such as El Bajo Aguan, the Aguan Valley, have increased. With in August, he sent about 600 military. He deployed about 600 military men out to this area where you have an incredible problem with land issues and campesinos, about 300,000 families that are without land at this point, seeking land and really land to work, right, to be able to work so that they don't have to migrate. So in some ways, he has done an insufficient job of trying to address the issues. He has not been, he's met people protesting the coup since 2009 with repression. As you mentioned earlier, there's been over 11 deaths just in August, September in the Valley of Aguan. We've had activists and labor leaders that have been kidnapped, beaten, threatened. The situation is increasingly, it's getting increasingly problematic for anybody in Honduras that is sort of protesting the coup and are in resistance to all of these increasing military aid and deployment in Honduras.
When President Lobo was speaking at the OAS this week, he talked about closing the chapter on this period, this post-coup period in Honduras. But you're bringing up several issues that appear to be unresolved. One of them is this violent situation in Bajo Aguan. Talk more about that. That's where the oil palm tree plantations cover much of the land. There's been killing of local farm leaders. A village was burned down. What has been Lobo's response to the violence there?
The way that Pepe Lobo has addressed the issue was to bring in more violence, bring in more police, and allow these private military to hire shadow forces or paramilitary forces that are well-armed, that have, serious armament, trucks, that intimidate campesinos when they're going to their little milpas or small corn farms, that threaten them, that are in sort of work together with the police to threaten people and accuse campesinos that want land.
When you travel through the region, what do you hear from people? Is there a way for them to express their opposition or their opinions about how things are going now, 2 years after the coup that removed Zelaya from power?
When I travel through the North Coast, particularly via Juan Valley, people feel completely stressed. They're living since June 2009. Complete insecurity. They feel that at any moment they could be arrested, at any moment they could be stopped going into their small plots to work their land, at any moment they can be accused. So they're feeling a great sense of insecurity, increased militarization.
The OAS, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that Lobo referred to, did find that the June 2009 coup was illegal. It also put responsibility on Zelaya for events leading to the coup. Now, Lobo has said he will step down in 2014 when his term ends. What's next for the people of Honduras, especially for those expressing dissent with Lobo?
In these 2 years, the Honduran resistance movement and the Honduran labor movement, the Honduran women's movement, the Honduran LGBT movement have matured in some really interesting ways. And it'll be really interesting to see that movement evolve and challenge and promise. And what the promise of that brings is a new way to conceive of Honduras as a nation that is democratic. So that's what to look forward to. I think Pepe Lobo in some ways is stuck. I don't think he's going to go anywhere or make any changes that are going to be relevant. I think it is up to the new generations and this new mature movement that is rising to see what's going to happen in Honduras and how that can be carried out.
So Yapa Portillo is a professor at the California State University Northridge. She joined us to talk about the visit of Honduran President Porfirio Lobo to Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In New York, activists and Muslim community members are trying to come up with a concrete set of actions to counter a police spying unit. In August, AP reported that the police department was using undercover officers to monitor ethnic communities and had investigated hundreds of mosques and infiltrated dozens more. On Monday, civil rights lawyers asked a Manhattan judge to compel the police department to reveal records about the secret program. Last night at a town hall meeting, activists and community members discussed other options to shutter the controversial program. FSRN's Salim Rizvi has more.
Muslims and activists have now launched a fight against the so-called demographics unit of the New York Police Department. Critics call it a discriminatory spying that singles out Muslims. The town hall meeting on the issue was attended by around 50 people, including representatives of various community and religious organizations. Activists and Muslim community members discussed a multi-pronged strategy to stop the New York Police Department from spying on Muslims and their mosques and other public places. Cyrus McGoldrick is the civil rights manager at the Council on American Islamic Relations in New York. He conducted the meeting.
The Muslim community and all communities, all concerned communities, are going to approach this from every angle possible. And I think that's the most important part, that, you know, certainly, legal action, might be necessary. And a lot of people are already talking about it. Absolutely, education, is a priority, because too many Muslims here and many people who are active politically or civically, don't know what their rights are, for example, and don't know the context for programs like this. Now that we really need to focus on the goal, which is the dismantling of this program, of this spy program, it's really important that we attack it from all angles, from the political side, from the legal side, from the media side. We have not really been able to build the momentum yet, but we need to make sure that we do. So we'll expand the campaign, in all ways possible to reach as many people as possible. This is one of those rare times, in history, when if people really knew all the facts, everyone would be in agreement. Yeah.
Those gathered said the police department is criminalizing the beliefs and practices of Muslim New Yorkers and are calling upon all Americans to stand up to defend the country's principles. Activists and community members at the meeting agreed on increasing political pressure on the city's elected representatives to force the police department to discontinue the program. Asim Rahman is the vice president of the Muslim Bar Association of New York.
Well, city council involvement is very important. At the end of the day, law enforcement activity is local and safety is local. And so we look to our city council to be a proper check on law enforcement. At the end of the day, city council approves law enforcement's budget. We know that there are members of city council who have taken very strong positions against the NYPD for what they think is racial profiling. There are responsible ways for going about telling the NYPD that what they're doing is irresponsible.
Activists also say that constitutional rights should not be sacrificed to ensure national security. They are quite hopeful that a concerted effort by all communities will lead to favorable results. Sarah Flounders is with the International Action Center, a New York-based rights organization which coordinates activism to oppose domestic and international injustices.
Thinking collectively about what measures on different fronts also. That was a very interesting part of the meeting, on political action, on long-term, on immediate response, a new situation, concrete groups that could be reached out to. It was a very good meeting facing a big problem, a very big problem.
In August, the Associated Press revealed in an investigative report that the NYPD monitors Muslims and their religious and other public places with help from the CIA. The CIA has since launched an investigation of the agency's involvement in the program because it is prohibited by law to spy on Americans. According to the AP, the NYPD has a special demographics unit that focuses surveillance on 29 ethnicities from mainly Muslim countries. The police department denies that it racially profiles Muslims, but civil rights activists demand that the New York City Council and Mayor Michael Bloomberg enforce a law that prohibits the use of racial or ethnic profiling by law enforcement officers. In the next 2 weeks, a core group of activists and community members will meet again to formulate the future course of action. Salim Rizvi, FSR in New York City.
As the Occupy Wall Street movement continues to spread across the country, the New York occupation received a major boost today from New York's powerful labor and community groups who rallied and marched in support. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr brings us the story.
Since Occupy Wall Street's launch on September 17th, the vast majority of the participants have been white youth. But the campers, who seek to end corporate influence in politics and create a more equitable economic system, continue to draw more supporters. Over the past week, major unions and community groups have publicly backed the protests. So far largely absent from the encampment, these groups represent working-class New Yorkers hardest hit by the economic downturn and government austerity measures. Transport Workers United Local 100 was the first major city union to support the protesters, and other labor and community groups have since followed suit. Transit union member John Bolton says the wealthy need to pay their fair share to fund the Metropolitan Transportation Authority and other public services.
Wall Street doesn't give a damn about MTA, you know, because they don't ride the MTA. And so they expect poor people to pay fares, which keep going up every year. And that's just not responsible. And we got to make it possible for everyone to get to where they're going, get to work. And I work construction, so I've seen firsthand crumbling, tunnels, leaks. I've seen tracks that need to be replaced. We're going to have a major incident.
Transport union workers who provide transportation for the city filed a lawsuit this week challenging the police commandeering of buses for transferring arrested protesters. A judge denied a temporary injunction but has not ruled on their lawsuit. Five of the estimated 700 arrested last Saturday on the Brooklyn Bridge are seeking a class action lawsuit against the police department and city, arguing they violated their constitutional rights. Despite the ongoing repression, community organizer Florence Johnson says she's inspired the protests continue.
And I am so damn proud of them for standing up for the rest of us when we didn't have the courage, when their parents didn't have the courage or the strength to stand up.
Johnson, a native of Jamaica, Queens, is with the group The Fight for a Fair Economy. She says she's mobilizing communities like her own that have been disproportionately affected by Wall Street excesses.
The house next door to me has been abandoned and foreclosed for years. and became basically a garbage dump. They just cleaned it out. The house on the opposite side of me, the person who owned it was forced to sell it at a short sale because she just couldn't pay the mortgage. After 5 years of paying into the house, she had to get out by the skin of her teeth, lose money, okay? And you're never supposed to lose money on real estate.
Following the economic downturn, New York lawmakers began slashing spending on education and youth job programs. On Friday, more than 700 public school employees working at the city's neediest schools will lose their jobs. Johnson says poor communities are hit the hardest by lack of investment in education and job creation.
If you look at my streets, the kids on my streets don't have jobs. They're not being educated. I don't care what Michael Bloomberg says. They are not being educated, and they can't find jobs.
Students at New York City and state universities are also mobilizing. They call for walkouts at campuses across the state Wednesday to protest cuts to higher education. 22-year-old Manhattan resident Jason Javier has been organizing on campus. He says those most affected are students who come from low-income backgrounds, like the majority who attend the City University of New York.
Now, since CUNY doesn't have any money, what does that mean? Tuition needs to go up, and there is a plan to increase the tuition $300 per year for the next 5 years, and then $500 on top of that. So tuition's going up. Since there's no money in school, there's a lot of reduction of resources, including mentors, remedial programs, and just student services, including faculty. You know, so they're just being attacked from so many different levels.
Earlier this year, some New Yorkers carried out another protest encampment called Bloombergville. Dozens camped out for weeks to protest cuts to the city budget. But without meaningful union and community support, the camp was unable to accomplish its goals. Occupy Wall Street protester Yotam Merim, who took part in Bloombergville, acknowledges these movements need to make sustained efforts to build working class support.
Basically, what the unions and the community groups bring along with them is a lot of people who have been organizing in New York, in marginalized communities, and a lot of those people who are hardest hit by economic crisis and also racism and sexism and all the other like oppressions that we all face. So those people, they bring that struggle here, and they also bring concrete demands because they fight around those concrete demands all the time. That's incredibly important for this kind of movement of faith, to ground itself in really concrete struggles that are actually taking place all the time in New York City.
Further community mobilizations have been announced throughout the week, including a call for members of Brooklyn's Haitian community to march to Wall Street on Friday. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Alice Olstein. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapshi and Shauna Ray. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. More information is available on our website at fsrn.org. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.